Is it true that Jed Skinker, the most eligible bachelor of the class of 86, is living in the sticks where the only women are his cows? It was true, for 2 years anyway, during which Jed rose at dawn, tucked himself in at night with a glass of whiskey and back copies of American Farmer. And would be true still, Jed thought, bestirring himself to read the last paragraph of the prospectus. Except that Hugh, who rode his bicycle to the bank and played squash 4 mornings a week at the racquet club, had dropped dead on the sidewalk outside of Skinker at age 65. Jed's mother had called him at the farm to tell him. He remembered the moment perfectly, because they'd had an early spring and a warm May, and the hay would be good. It was mid-June, and he and Billy agreed they were about 2 weeks away from cutting. As he packed for the city, he thought of the buyout offers that he knew would come rolling in, clung to them, maybe. In the event, though, his mother didn't want to sell. "Mr. Skinker?" Belatedly, Jed was aware of laughter in the outer office. Women's laughter. "Errol Ann, come in." "Sal?" He rose from his desk. "Is that you?"
"I know you said no calls, Mr. Skinker," said Carol Ann when Jed threw open the door. "But I figured your sister, Sally, in New York?"
"'Tis a hi, Jeddy," said Sally.
"Aw," as Jed crushed her in a hug, getting a noseful of the cheap shampoo she used on her blunt-cut blonde bowl.
"Big brother, why didn't you call?"
"You see," Sally said to Carol Ann, who was watching the pair with merriment. Carol Ann was as fond of Sally as anyone.
"I've just been telling Carol Ann, because I didn't want you to make a reservation at a nice restaurant. You know how I loathe them, so theatrical. Would you like still or sparkling? And such a grand waste of time. Of course I don't want bottled water."
Sally shook herself like a dog after a swim. Jed took her in. The solidity of her in her clerical collar and black skirt and blouse. Despite having grown up here, his sister had little use for the city, looking on its basic assumptions with the alert, unconvinced mien of an outsider. She came down from Danforth as little as possible.
"We'll have something in the office. Carol Ann, could you..."
"No, no." Sally was shaking her head.
"I didn't want to trouble Carol Ann either, so you see..."
She held up a paper bag from one of the sandwich places nearby.
"BLTs on whole wheat. You eat too much white bread, Jed. You need to lose 30 pounds, and you know it."
"She brought drinks, too, Mr. Skinker."
With mock severity, Sally said,
"Now, Carol Ann, we talked about this last time I was here. You were going to work on giving up the Mr. Skinker, weren't you?"
Carol Ann smiled sideways.
"I guess I got in the habit with Mr. Skinker."
By this, both Sally and Jed knew she meant their father.
"And I can't get out."
"Well, at least you'll call me Sally, and I grant..." She stepped back and cocked an eyebrow at her brother. "He's rather impressive in this context. I usually see him in overalls in a calf shed, you know."
"It's good to see you, Sally," said Carol Ann.
Jed's assistant made his sister seem young and brash, a crusader, raw. Jed had tried for a while to get Carol Ann to call him by his first name until he realized he was doing her no favors. The idea rattled her. Upset her, even. It would have been taking something away. She bought her suits and shoes at the department stores and always dressed appropriately for the season and the weather. On rainy days like today, Jed looked forward to seeing the galoshes. In snow, the fur-trimmed boots and hat came out. She was girlish in that way, but a serious girl. On her lunch break, she slipped out to Saks to make a small purchase, a lipstick or a pair of stockings, or to review a sale or exchange an item. She lived up in Yonkers and had lost her little sister to cancer.
"It's good to see you, Carol Ann," said Jed's sister, and gave the woman a hug before she retreated.
Only Sally would take such liberties, Jed thought. Sally had never gone through the post-childhood rejection of spontaneous contact. She was free with her hugs, her cuddles, her hand clasps.
"What are you doing in town, sis?"
With a concerned look around, as if her brother's office were somehow different than what she'd remembered from her last visit. Sally settled herself on the grommeted leather sofa. Jed took one of the upholstered armchairs opposite and watched her deftly sort out the sandwiches and drinks.
"A fresh start, of course."
This was Sally's drug rehabilitation charity upstate, a residency program for women in recovery. Other things came with the drug use. Battery, sexual abuse. She raised her intense round blue eyes to his.
"I need a better name," Two friends from seminary, Nancy and Bill, do you remember them? They're helping me fundraise. I'm terrible at it. I just sort of assume the money will come flooding in if the cause is worthy. She handed him a paper plate with a sandwich and a napkin, a can of seltzer water. It's like, well, I'd give. Her mouth full of sandwich, she asked, "You gave that man they sent you from St. Thomas's a job, didn't you? Carlos Flores? It helped me so much. It's the least I can do. And he did seem to be the cream of the recovery crop down here."
"Yeah, he's in the print shop."
Jed paused. "When he's not hooking up the junior bankers with all the blow they can handle." Sally looked shocked. "He's backdealing?" Jed turned his palms over. "What can you do? Dear God, I'll have to tell Nancy." "At least he's got a salary, capital to lay in some good product, right?" Sally stared at him for a second. Then her expression cleared. "Jed Skinker, you are so bad." Jed laughed.
"Sorry, from what I hear, he's a good employee."
"It's not funny." But after a moment, she relented with a snort.
"It's good seeing you out of context," he said.
Sally tried to glower, but he could see the comment pleased her. Up at the farm, brother and sister had lived side by side for a decade. She'd been renting when he inherited the place, and for years he'd been on her to take what they called the little house, the house where they had spent weekends as kids. It was 20 minutes closer to her church, and the parishioners liked the idea of her living in the community. "By which they mean the richer community," she said when she wasn't feeling charitable. But having the house and her whereabouts permanently settled, she admitted, freed her for other work, and finally she'd conceded. She loved her goddaughter, Laura, the more, Jed felt, as Laura got older and was better company. Gay, Sally had never come out in a big way. Jed had gathered there had been some disappointment in her romantic life a while back that precipitated her 2-year sabbatical from her church building schools and teaching in Kenya. When she got home, she seemed different, not exactly resigned, but as if she had accepted something. But he was preoccupied with the bank, Philippa, Laura's birth. And "are you happy" was not the sort of thing they asked each other. It would only make her scoff. Lest the housing arrangement fail, each understanding that siblings generally went their own ways in life, it had been from the start dogma that neither interfered in the other's plans or ever staked claims to the other's coming and going. So they frequently went a couple of weeks without a real conversation, even when Jed's family was up at the farm on the weekends.
"I need to come down more often," Sally said soberly.
"Why?" She raised her eyebrows as she ate her sandwich, as if it were obvious. "I'm becoming insulated up there, Jed. I'm becoming the kind of person, the kind of priest, whose focus is so local and so narrow that I'm losing touch with how the world works. I'm sitting on my stool at the Danforth Diner, chatting with Arlene and Joe, and I'm taking too much pleasure in being isolated from all this." She gestured at the room and glanced uncertainly around at the ancestor portraits on the walls, the triple monitor flat screen on the partner desk. "You're the one who's really in the world. I've retreated." She took an emphatic bite of her sandwich and said with her mouth full, "That's dangerous." "And the fundraising, are you really having trouble? No one to tap in your parish?" Sally's shoulders went up and down.
"Everyone cites the crisis, of course."
Jed said, "Why not let me chip in again? Us, I mean. We need more charitable donations."
"I defend you, you know," Sally said,
as if Jed had made a different statement entirely. "Bill and Nancy," she went on diffidently, with a glance at him, "they'd like to burn all you bankers at the stake. I told them the world needs banks, but they've got to be properly run."
"Not bad," Jed granted. "I may have to use that myself, so I can't write you another check. It's all I can do."
"Thank you," Sally said soberly. "But we still have some of the founding donations Skinker made. And I'm determined it will be more than that. I don't want it to be a pet charity, like one of Ma's, you know." She sat back, wiped her hands on a paper napkin, and then on her thighs, and said curiously, "Have you seen her?"
"Ma?"
Jed finished his BLT. He'd been hungrier than he realized. Sally always seemed to be providing nourishment, dropping off soup at some neighbor's whose husband had been injured on the job, a pan of lasagna for a GED graduation party. The maternal basics came easily to her, regular meals, bedtimes.
His mother, who had been known to call him at 7:30 on a weekday morning to ask if he knew whether his sister had considered. A new procedure I've been reading about, much better than IVF, where a man is not involved in any way. Failed to consider that Sally's children were the addicts, the victims of domestic abuse she tended, the middle-aged parishioners whose money couldn't save their souls. She always seems to be in East Hampton when I call. Has she got a boyfriend out there? Jed chuckled. No doubt. The moment their father died, Winnie had stopped her visits to the farm. She had spent her childhood in East Hampton, and giving it up for Danforth when she married had been a bitter pill to swallow. Phil would know, Jed said. Ma still tries to convince her we'd be happier out at the beach. When does she do that? When do you see her? We have her over for dinner once a week. Philippa cooks? Sally looked incredulous. No, Ma cooks. Or they'll order in steaks from Melons. Ma peppers Phil with questions. I'll bet. Phil doesn't seem to mind. It was strange. In the middle of replying to his sister, Jed glanced at the gold clock on the mantelpiece and felt dizzy, though he was seated. He must have closed his eyes for a second. The next thing he knew, he heard, "Jed, are you all right?" Sally had come to his chair, was kneeling down beside it. "You're not well, are you? You're tired, Jed. You don't look well. Are you ill?" Only Sally could look urgently steady, urgently kind. "I'm fine," he said automatically. "I just remembered something I have to do." When he didn't elaborate, she knew not to ask. Wordlessly, though, she scrutinized him. "It's a hassle," he assured her lightly. "But it's not important." Sally was not one to rush to fill a silence. He could feel those probing blue eyes of hers on his face. Still kneeling, she placed her hand on his arm and said quietly, "There's a man in Danforth, Jed. He's had great success with addiction. I've sent a couple of my direst girls to him. Hard cases. What I'm saying is that they could simply meet and talk. I could suggest it. Woman to woman, you know? I've noticed, Phil, that sometimes when you drink, you... that kind of thing. Leave you out." "Oh." Jed gave his sister's shoulder a pat. "It's not that, but thanks." Her brow furrowed. Sally observed him a moment longer. "Okay." She accepted his response, he knew. One early morning after an evening at the farm that had gone bad a couple of years ago, she had come upon him sweeping up broken glass from the kitchen floor. He'd felt he ought to say something, but before he could find the words, she'd let him off the hook, speaking first. "People have to come to things in their own time, don't they?" she'd remarked. "It's what I believe," he'd said. She got herself up off the safe now, walked to the casement windows, and looked out. First horizontally at the parking garage that had gone up a few years ago across the way, then cocking her head to gaze down to the street as everyone did. "I'd never get any work done here. I'd be staring down at the street all day, watching the comings and goings, making up stories about people." "I did," he said, "at first." She turned with a half-smile. "You were 29. "Yes." A worry came into her face. "This year's been terrible, hasn't it, Jed? I know you haven't even let on how terrible. There's a man in my congregation who was apparently quite high up at Lehman Brothers. He used to put $100 bill in the plate every week. A victim of the crisis, I guess you'd say." Sally spoke as if she were putting the term victim in quotes. It was no doubt difficult for her to get her tongue around the word when it applied to finance types for whom, despite her family name, she had little use. With a shake of her head, she crossed to the sofa, sat, and slowly finished the sandwich, a ruminative frown on her face. "He's a good man. They say he'll have to sell his place upstate."
"I'd never do that," Jed said. "I'd sell in the city, move to Danforth."
"You sound as if you got it all planned out," Sally said speculatively. She studied his face before balling up her trash. "I wish you would, you know." Jed nodded. "One day." "Jed?" She moved herself forward till she sat perched at the very edge of the leather sofa. Her eyes searched his. "She'll sacrifice you. You know that, don't you?" Jed demurred.
"You have been at the farm too long. There's nothing so dramatic as all that going on."
When she didn't respond, only kept her serious, steady gaze on him. He looked away and said offhandedly, "Skinker's all right, you know. So far we've come through all right." His sister had an admirable capacity for staying on message. It must have served her well in the parish when people tried to squirm out of obligations. "Jed?" she repeated. "She will sacrifice you if you let her." There was a moment, maybe. An odd gratitude for his only sibling stole over him. She was the only person on earth who he could know for certain was not referring to Philippa. His sister, in fact, quite liked Philippa. They shared some baseline of humor, some appreciation for the absurd that he understood intellectually but not viscerally. It was their, perhaps, a woman's thing. Their relationship would come in handy if he ever had to. He stopped himself. My God, the fatalism. Distress. However much you try to compartmentalize, it put you in an illogical frame of mind. The guilt clock chimed the hour. "Ack, is that right? I've got to be going." Sally wanted to make sure she caught the express, not the local. "As much as I love you, brother, I can't stand that slow train." He walked her down the three curving marble flights, mindful of the time, glad he could show her out without having to make up an excuse. The meeting was still 45 minutes away, unless, of course, he canceled. Curtis had canceled before. That was almost worse. The emptiness of the afternoon afterward, left with his thoughts, but somehow unable to go home early to Phil and the children. They stood briefly in the elegant black-and-white marble foyer, Jed's favorite spot in the building. "You're up this weekend, right? Phil's supposed to come to the center with me Saturday." "Is she?" Jed was surprised. "Yes, Jed, they loved her. The time we went before?" Sally dug in her handbag and took out a cheap black umbrella. "You see? They look at me," Sally said. "And they think, well, of course this chubby middle-aged woman priest is going to be doing our laundry and making us tea and buying us books we'll never read. She never had any options. No wonder she became a Christer." "Now, Sal, doesn't understand temptation, never had any. Whereas Philippa, beautiful, sophisticated, married woman, big rock on her hand, well, it is big, Jed, who can't dress down if she tries, who's volunteering her time to be with them. Well, it's flattering, that's what it is. They know Philippa could be elsewhere. Me, they take for granted, as they should," she said when Jed made to interrupt again. "As they should, I wouldn't have it any different." "And how do you handle—" Jed stopped, but not out of delicacy. He only wanted to understand how, in a rehabilitation center, his wife— "Oh, I don't get into it," Sally said simply. She added neutrally, as if she had no great expectation about it. "Perhaps she'll learn from them." Sally stood on tiptoes to give him a kiss. "Coming up tomorrow or Saturday?" "Tomorrow. Late." "How late?" 9, 10. I've got some stuff to take care of today that'll keep me out of the office," Jed said vaguely. He would never have told her, and anyway, he didn't want to. The only person he wished he could tell was Phil, because she would understand the type of person he was up against, the weak-eyed devil. Oh, she knew the type well. And she would have been able to help him, console him. She alone could always console him. "Do not speed," Sally was saying. "I don't care if you go and break your neck, but not with your precious cargo." She shook her head balefully. Jed's driving was something they'd fought about since adolescence. She had gone the other way, two hands on the wheel, pedantically signaling to change lanes, even when there were no other cars in sight. "The thing about it is," she'd said once, "it doesn't suit you. You're not the type to speed. It's beneath you. It's the only thing Ma and I agree on." "And it's the one thing Ma doesn't control," Jed had thought. Rounding the first bend in the road as he left the farm as a 16-year-old, he'd felt free, high. Even Hugh had nothing to do with cars, found them irritating necessities. Whereas Jed was a tinkerer, better at getting Billy Flood's tractor restarted than Billy was. "I never speed with the kids," he protested. "And anyway, you can't speed. Too many cops now." Sally wasn't having any of it. "Right. And they're about as likely to arrest Jed Skinker as their own mothers." Jed held the door for her, and she went out into the rain, opening the cheap umbrella, half the prongs of which were bent or detached from the fabric. She hadn't gone 5 yards before she turned and yelled, "I forgot to tell you, Roxy's gotten herself pregnant." Roxy was the farm's German shepherd. "What? I thought she was too old." "Spoken like a typical man. She's due in April." Jed had an immediate thought. "Can we keep them a secret?" he yelled. "For Ruth's birthday, I'll only tell Phil. Well, maybe Lolo, too." She grinned and held up two thumbs, the ridiculous excuse for an umbrella waving wildly overhead. To repeat, we had nothing against her. In fact, we all really liked her. It was common when we were sitting around murmuring about the latest affront for one of us to say self-righteously, "Lest there be some mistake. I mean, I actually like her." The rest of us, not to be outdone, would cry, "Well, so do I, so do I." And the one of us who had passed on the particular complaint that had captivated us moments before would say defensively, "I wasn't saying I didn't like her." So it was established that we all, every one of us, really liked her. At the same time, you have to admit that she was an anomaly. She was an anomaly and, at times, almost an affront. Perhaps that sounds self-involved and silly on our part. What did the problems of one former fashion model have to do with us, after all? But once in a while, in a quiet moment at pickup or drop-off, you might see one of us glance at her in a rather irritated way. Again, it wasn't that we didn't like her. It's just that our world turned on the cogs of certain accepted middle-class expectations. Call them upper-middle, if you must. That she failed to meet. I don't mean anything so lofty as moral expectations. We slotted in the vacations. We ran our children through the necessary extracurricular activities so they would never have to suffer the ignominies we suffered in any popular sport or pastime. We exercised. We at least did yoga. We carefully chose foyer sconces, backsplashes, accent pillows. It was known that these were things that one did. And the playdates. The playdates. We hosted playdates for one another's children for our mutual benefit. Of course, we knew that in the case of the working moms, they would not be home. It would be the nannies. This was no issue at all to accommodate. But she, Philippa Lye. In the fall of the threes class, when her daughter Laura, the elder one, was at St. Tim's, we'd email Philippa to see if Laura was free, throwing out a date. "This Thursday any good?" As the days elapsed and we didn't hear from her, we found ourselves growing frustrated with that sense of powerlessness we hadn't experienced since we got out of the dating market. We'd remind ourselves that she hadn't asked us to ask her. It was, of course, our own problem if her rudeness, "I'm sorry, but at this point that's all I can call it," got to us. But the knowledge only incensed us, for we had thought we were done with game-playing and one-upmanship. What? Were we supposed to employ the old dating strategies on her? Such as never call her first. Wait 3 days to return the call if she called us. Never assume a date was a date. The worst part was that we suspected, as we had with those young men who took so much strategizing to manage in our 20s, that her failures in communication had nothing whatsoever to do with us. Pretending that she was guilty of social manipulation was our way of telling ourselves that we did matter. We did count. "It's not that I don't like her. I just don't have time for this," said we to one another in exasperation. "And it's sad because it's the little girl who suffers," watching the child wait with that forbearing look when her mother failed to make pickup again. Once, one late fall afternoon near Thanksgiving, oh, years ago now, she never came at all. The father, let's not be coy, Jedediah Skinker, was traveling for the bank, and they didn't have anything like a proper nanny. Only some old family retainer who lurked about the apartment but didn't schlep. The number one requirement of a school-aged child's babysitter. Eventually, so we heard at the tail end of the day, Philippa's mother-in-law, Winifred Skinker, came to collect the girl in a cab. She was an old classmate from Smith of Mrs. Davidson, the head of St. Tim's. I would have liked to be a fly on the wall when the old chums had a word that afternoon. Except that, given the almost pathological circumspection of their generation, It was unlikely that either would have referred to the elephant in the room. Then, like the very worst of the men we dated in our 20s, just when we were ready to escalate the situation publicly because we had been pushed to the limit, she'd come over to one of us and say, in that uncomfortably intent way of hers that made you feel she was looking directly into the most shameful part of your soul, "You're Teddy's mom, aren't you? You emailed me. I'm sure you emailed me. Laura would adore a playdate. Just adore one. Could you come to us?" As we sputtered to get our bearings, she'd say, "What about this afternoon? Could you have lunch with us? Lolo, wouldn't it be a blast if Teddy and his mom had lunch at our house today?" In our little group, it was Marnie Pete who first had the privilege of going over to Philippa's for a playdate. This was a few years ago, when Laura Skinker was still at preschool, and the boy, Sebastian, was a baby. It happened about 6 months before Marnie and James left for Hong Kong, when she was pregnant with number two. We all wanted to know what the apartment was like, but Marnie wasn't very observant in that way. Her own place was floor-to-ceiling Pottery Barn, giant clocks, lobster traps for coffee tables, apothecary shop for a kitchen. So all we got was, it wasn't very renovated, and the fact that Laura's unframed school pictures were tacked directly to the wall in her room. A graying African-American woman in a uniform fixed them lunch, and it was this sort of gelatinous beef stew. A proper sit-down hot lunch. The very idea made us squirm. Marnie almost died because Teddy wouldn't eat a bite and made increasingly appalling comments. "Gross! What is this? Take it away, Mommy!" While Laura Skinker sat soberly working her way through the whole bowl. Philippa ate the whole bowl. That was remarkable because everyone assumed she didn't eat. "No," Marnie insisted. "Not at all. She ate like a horse. Stew, potatoes, an unrecognizable green vegetable." Marnie said she became self-conscious about how she was holding her silverware, wondered whether she ought to cross American style or keep her fork facing down European style, which had always seemed more natural to her. There was a lot of art. She remembered that much. She said some of it was old, but some of it was modern, you know, shapes but faded. Love Marnie. And there were lighter things as well. She recalled a watercolor of a Jersey cow in the powder room. There were photographs in silver frames on a beaten-up grand piano. A fireplace, she recalled vaguely. No, fireplaces. A claustrophobic back kitchen painted yellow with a swinging restaurant door. Some dying houseplants. Ferns? Aloe plants? We asked her for more specifics. What sort of a sofa did she have? Did she own a television? Asked her to describe the furniture, the rugs, the layout of the place. But Marnie simply couldn't remember. Nothing really stood out, she claimed. About halfway through the meal, Philippa got a call on the home phone. She excused herself and took the call in her bedroom. Marnie had to sit there talking to the children and making conversation with a maid, who was not unpleasant but slow-moving and reticent. Then the children started asking her what they could do. Laura Skinker asked if Teddy wanted to watch television. Ah, so Philippa Lai did have a television. Oh, no, Marnie said. No TV on a playdate, Teddy. Eventually, she got them playing an ancient game of chutes and ladders she dug out of some cupboard. She had to get down on the floor and play, too, to make it stick. And she felt heavy and awkward not only because she was pregnant, but because she didn't like taking charge in another woman's house. And she despaired of Philippa's ever coming back. After a prolonged absence, when Marnie was considering simply packing up and going, Philippa reappeared. She apologized but explained nothing, said only, "I'm so sorry. I had to take that call." She looked a little shell-shocked, and then, to Marnie's surprise, she said vehemently, "God damn it to hell!" Marnie tried to pacify her. By that point, she was thrilled just to have another adult in the room. She said the usual things that one says when one has no specifics. "I hope everything's okay." Philippa looked at her very closely, very intently, and said something like, "I can tell you really understand," and embraced her, which Marnie found bizarre. Eventually, she noticed the children who were being good and playing their game, and Marnie said Philippa absolutely beamed. "They're getting along really, really well, aren't they?" she cried.
We'll have to do this again. You must come over more often. Marnie was frankly embarrassed now. She'd thought Philippa would be sort of remote and hard to get to know, and that they'd keep it safe and discuss St. Tim's and holiday plans. That was Marnie's idea anyway. She was ready to talk tidily of the condo they'd rented at Steamboat. And instead, she was being embraced like an old, intimate friend. Philippa asked her, very seriously, "Did you eat lunch?" And then, "Did your son finish his stew?" And the, by all counts, worst mother in New York City actually gave Marnie a lecture on nutrition in which she emphasized, get this, the evils of prepackaged food. By now, Marnie felt like breaking the fourth wall and just looking out at the audience and saying, where the fuck does she get off? But it got better. For Marnie noticed the oddest thing. Philippa was drinking. Marnie kept this from us till the very end of her recounting. But yes, when Philippa came out of the bedroom, she was drinking red wine out of a water glass that she periodically refilled from a bottle on the sideboard in the dining room. She was matter-of-fact about it in the extreme. So matter-of-fact that she never even offered Marnie a glass. Marnie drank very little, generally, even when she wasn't pregnant. But something about the encounter was so distressing, she would have accepted a glass had she been offered one. She emphasized this. And I would have downed it in one gulp. It all went downhill from there. If you can imagine that there was still any vertical distance to descend. The children tired of the game. Teddy started wandering around looking for things to destroy while Marnie chased after him, feeling increasingly enraged and idiotic. The girl, Laura, went and sat on the sofa on her mother's lap and put her cheek on her mother's chest, and they stayed in this silent embrace so long that Marnie became flustered and said she had to go before he wrecked something. Philippa gave no sign of appreciating her good humor and didn't even get up to see poor Marnie to the door. Marnie kept thanking her and saying she really had to go. And from the sofa, Philippa gave her a distant look and said, "Do you?" As if Marnie had invited herself over. Then she said, out of the blue, "My mother's dying. I just found out. That was my sister on the phone." Well, that was it. Marnie gave a groan of protest. It was simply too much. "I'm very sorry to hear that, Philippa," she said, and walked straight out the door, collecting stroller toys and jackets and mittens and shepherding her child as she went. In the mirror in the elevator, she saw that she looked like a harridan. Her face was red, and her hair was sticking out all over, and whatever makeup she'd put on was long gone. She overthanked the doorman who showed her out, as if to preserve some connection or make up for some failure on her part. She got out onto the street, and she cried. I cannot explain the effect Marnie's recounting of the playdate had on us, except to say that while we thought we would be happy to get the details, we were not. All the fun had gone out of it, not just out of gossiping, but out of getting and spending. Perhaps a better way to put it is that for a couple of weeks we all stopped Googling Hampton's real estate. How could you live like that? How could you get away with it? How could you not enroll your children in extracurricular activities? Ought our help to be uniformed? We like to organize, to run a tight ship, to laugh among ourselves and be satisfied in small things. Closet reorganizations, baking feats. Hell, we loved one another, but would never have said it. Our children we did tell we loved, but as a perfunctory bedtime sign-off that expressed less than saying nothing at all. We deflected compliments. We made deprecating comments about how much we had eaten at the last meal, and how lazy we were, and how badly we sucked at tennis when in fact we were not at all lazy and we were very good tennis players. Needless to say, poor Marnie never got another invitation. As a child would, instead of blaming Philippa, she seemed to internalize the shame, looking glum when the Skinkers came up in conversation, no longer enjoying the speculation about them. When Philippa saw Marnie at school, she didn't acknowledge her except for the same distracted nod we all got, if we even got that. Until they moved to Hong Kong, and there are those who say Marnie urged James to take the job in part to get away from Philippa Lye, Marnie would have to stand there watching Philippa pick up Laura. And while the rest of us gave an appropriate, tight-lipped little smile to our own children, so as not to display the favoritism that we all felt, Philippa would swoop down on her daughter
and envelop her in a massive hug, crying, "Hello, my gorgeous girl. Did you have a wonderful day?" And each one of us remembered, in a depth of bumming out, the moment in pre-adolescence when we had learned from either our parents or our peers that one had to pretend not to care. But to be clear, we had nothing against her. We actually really liked her. We really, really liked Philippa Lai. Chapter 9. Minnie Curtis spoke in a bright, inflectionless tone as the elevator doors opened, depositing them directly into the vestibule of 7-8-A. "Welcome to my humble abode." The remark was so off-key that Gwen simply failed to respond. She wasn't sure what she had been expecting. A flashy post-war with a surfeit of bathrooms? But it wasn't this. Stepping into the outsized chandeliered foyer, she wasn't immediately sure, in fact, what this was. From the foyer, she could see through French doors into an immense dining room in which a dozen Queen Anne chairs were pulled up to a mahogany pedestal table. Hunting prints hung on red walls. To her right, an imposing staircase led to the second floor, its oriental runner tacked to the treads with brass rods. The apartment seemed to have been done to an opulent yet oddly corporate effect. In front of her, atop a round library table, a massive flower arrangement strained menacingly from an oversized Chinese vase that might have been priceless or might have been Pier 1. Or rather, the apartment had not been done, Gwen reminded herself, looking back belatedly to check on Mary, grateful to see that she had plopped down in the elevator vestibule to remove her shoes. Minnie had decorated it herself. Mistrusting professions such as interior design, she'd made clear on the car ride up, for which the fees were high and the services aesthetically based. "Who would pay someone for that?" she demanded of Gwen. "I mean, honestly, I know what I want." Allowing this with a nod, for she had no basis on which to refute it, Gwen had another insight into why John Curtis had married Minnie, child and all, besides the obvious, oft-sighted one of her being hot. Curtis clearly had ambitions to social status, or Gwen assumed he did. Those multicolored polo shirts and madras shorts, she felt, would not have been lightly jettisoned, but he wouldn't have put up with that same type of vulnerability in a wife. Minnie had ambitions, yes, but like many successful people in New York, she was extra-societal. If she'd wanted her kid at St. Tim's, the reason no doubt was that she'd heard it was the best, the same as she'd want the best range, the biggest diamond, and not that she felt, like the true social climber, that it would mean anything or say something thematic about where she had gotten in life. It was just that the best was the best was the best. She did seem to take pride in her economics, arbitrary as they were. Her opining on the worthlessness of the decorating profession had occurred in the back seat of Minnie's Cadillac Escalade, driven by Minnie's driver. His and hers, she explained to Gwen. They had found to be a better arrangement than sharing a car. In the middle seat row of the black leather interior, Mary Hogan had gone silent before Arabella Curtis and the aura, not exactly a privilege, but of stuff. Lots and lots of stuff having been gotten in her name that emanated from Minnie's only child. Mary hadn't so much as looked at Arabella, instead staring down at the footwell with an expression of alarm, as if the unseen forces that had placed her in the older girl's proximity could at any moment cast her out again. When Gwen tried to break the spell with a word to her daughter, Mary shook her head briefly, concentrating. "My God," said Minnie, "she looks so serious." Gwen let the comment pass. For a certain kind of adult, she had learned, her daughter's presence seemed to constitute a rebuke. Arabella was watching Mary laboring over the buckles of her shoes. The older girl had a look of amusement on her face, as if this were a revelation, how the little people lived, obeying commands, respecting property. She was wearing a smart houndstooth coat with a black patent leather belt by one of the high-end fashion designers now producing children's clothing lines. She yanked the coat off as she came into the foyer, tossed it in the direction of the banister, and looked the other way when she missed. Gwen gave a loud, one-syllable laugh at this spoiled performance, and then, to cover it up, bent to pick up the coat herself. "Oh, Gwen, you don't have to do that," said Minnie, busy with the elaborate closures on her own designer coat. toggles and zippers and interior buttons, but her tone suggested that servility never hurt. There were too many rich people. That was the problem. The audience had been thinning for a long time. Everybody needed a Gwen, but there weren't enough Gwens to go around. Someone to whom a ride in one's private car, a visit to one's McMansion of an apartment, was pure touristing diversion. Bring it on, Gwen thought, tilting her head back to examine the elaborate inlay of the ceiling.
I'm playing with my Wii, Mum, Arabella announced.
I forgot to tell you. Minnie eyed herself in a heavy gilt mirror opposite the door, turning her sleek head this way and that. I invited Philippa as well, your childhood friend, right?
Oh, did you?
Gwen felt an immediate sense of misgiving that she had ever mentioned the connection. As I said, we weren't really friends, she hastened to say. It was more her sister and I.
Mom, I'm playing with my Wii.
Hola, Arabella.
A broad-faced Hispanic housekeeper hustled in, laughing and ducking her head.
Hola, princesita.
Say hello to Lupe, Arabella.
Keeping up a stream of giggles, Lupe collected the coats and ferried them off to a closet that had one of those false, knobless doors Gwen could never see the point of.
I'm playing with my Wii, Mum, and they're not to touch the karaoke.
The girl retained a trace of the English accent she'd picked up in preschool, a trace of the English diction. It enhanced the imperious quality she projected. Gwen stifled an urge to laugh again. She rarely thought of her husband during the day, but now she couldn't not think of him, of Dan Hogan's reaction to this Richie Rich episode she'd landed herself in. In the past, they had laughed so often and so long about other people's follies.
Are these real?
Mary said loudly, planting herself in front of the giant flowers.
They're not real. I don't think they're real.
Now, Mare.
No one is to touch the Wii karaoke except me,
Arabella called, running for the stairs. Minnie was now applying lipstick in the mirror, as if she were about to go out.
They are real, Mom,
exclaimed Mary, giving one of the petals a tug. Gwen lunged and stopped the entire vase from toppling, just.
Yes, honey,
she said shakily. They are. Oblivious, Minnie gave a dental patient's grin into the mirror, flashing her white teeth.
Arabella, you lucky,
Lupe called, hustling back to the foot of the stairs.
You have nice friend to play.
She was the clanging, happy type of nanny some people went in for, Gwen saw, but whose tone deafness always sort of alarmed her.
Mom!
Arabella was lingering at the top of the stairs now.
You haven't answered me, Mom!
The girl's eyes were screwed shut. Her voice rose to a shriek on the last word. Mary stared frankly up at the girl, pleased and intrigued by this display.
Arabella, princesita, don't talk to Mommy like that. Arabella, your friend, Mom!
Gwen blushed and was mumbling something to Mary when Minnie said,
Have you ever seen such a naughty, ungrateful girl, Gwen?
I'm throwing the Wii in the trash,
Minnie yelled disgustedly up the stairs.
You're a rude, spoiled girl, Arabella. Daddy spoils you. You deserve a spanking, and you'll get one later, do you hear me?
At the top of the stairs, Arabella put her hands over her ears and began to shout, sing,
Happy birthday to me! Happy birthday to me!
Mary guffawed at this performance, which seemed to incense Arabella. She gave a murderous frown, stomped her foot, and sang louder, which made Mary laugh louder.
Mom, she's singing happy birthday, and it's not her birthday.
Yes, she is.
Nobody believes in spanking anymore, do they?
Minnie said plaintively to Gwen, or rather to the mirror into which she was still gazing, now with a pouty expression.
It's not her birthday, is it, Mom?
I don't think so.
Well, I was spanked as a child.
The pronouncement stilled the room, adults and children alike. Quivering in her pride, Minnie at last turned her face from the mirror.
Spanked, and I mean beaten, with my mother's hairbrush, or a wooden spoon, a belt, anything she could get her hands on.
Gwen hesitated, her hand on Mary's shoulder. She had been spanked, of course, but somehow she felt it wasn't validation that Minnie was after. Upstairs, Arabella cackled and ran off.
Oh, miss!
Lupe laughed and shook her head, toiling up the stairs after the girl, pausing to hold out her hand for Mary, who couldn't be invited fast enough. Gwen guessed that two or three less sycophantic women had come before Lupe, and not worked out. The middle-aged white woman, for instance, who had suddenly stopped appearing at school. Lupe wouldn't work out ultimately either. Minnie, Gwen was certain, would burn through help like brands of detergent, congratulating herself on each capricious replacement.
"Come on,"
Minnie said with a disconcertingly warm smile at Gwen.
"I need a drink."
The kitchen was vast, suburban size, as even city kitchens must be nowadays. It glistened like an operating theater with menacing, hyper-clean appliances. Minnie gestured to a row of backless stools pulled up to a dark, speckled marble counter.
"Have a seat at our breakfast bar, Gwen."
After hesitating a second to see if this moment was meant ironically, Gwen did as she was told while, from a double-wide, steel-doored refrigerator, Minnie removed an open bottle of white wine and yanked out the cork.
"John is so into wine and I could give a crap. He's all Opus One this, Romane Conti that.
He gets it from his boss, from Martin Kerr. Real wine snob, Marty.
I'll tell you a secret, Gwen."
"Yes?" Gwen tried to smile to soften how deathly serious she sounded. In a stage whisper, Minnie said,
"Sometimes I doubt if he can tell the difference between the $10 stuff I drink and his $200 bottles."
From a cupboard, she got down two crystal balloon-type glasses that seemed to have been fabricated on the same scale as the kitchen. After filling them nearly all the way, she handed one to Gwen.
"Big cheers!"
"Oh," said Gwen. "Cheers." There was a natural pause after the toast, which Gwen ought to have filled by telling Minnie that she had gone to college with Minnie's husband, knew who he was, knew him a little. It would have been natural to do so. Instead, she kept silent. She was unable to think of what she could add. What a great guy. Yet it occurred to her that, from here on in, she was operating under false pretenses.
"John loves going to the auctions, just loves it. Do you know we've got 800 bottles in storage?"
"I was just lying there, and he..."
800? Wow,"
Gwen said hastily. Minnie clicked around the kitchen in today's ferocious stilettos, fixing a tray of snacks for the children.
"I say, give me my mommy's Chardonnay and a couple of ice cubes, and I'm good."
"Sure,"
Gwen said vaguely. There was a fascinating falseness to almost everything Minnie said. Even when Gwen had gotten the ride home from school with her that one time, and Minnie had filled Gwen in, unprompted, on her disadvantaged childhood, the narrative had been filled with hesitations and false starts that ended in non sequiturs, as if she were making up the disadvantaged part, and in reality came from money, the colonial sugar fortune, say, that people sometimes still linked to her name.
She drank too much. You could call her, well, nowadays everyone's an alcoholic, but she... Well, I mean, we kids, we really had to behave.
When Gwen, feeling obliged to continue the conversation, had asked a neutral question as to whether Minnie had any brothers or sisters, that, too, provoked switchbacks so bizarre, Gwen wondered if the whole story was a sham.
"Yes, well, no, actually, I've got a half-brother. I mean, I've got two half-brothers, but one doesn't count because he's in jail. I mean, not jail, but, well, he is locked up."
But her falseness didn't have the quality of dread, of covering up and defensiveness one typically associated with people who lied. It was as if she was always attempting to charm. Even people like Gwen, which was flattering in its way. She was like a woman at a speed dating event, Gwen thought, who tries on a slightly different personality with every suitor. Arriving at school this afternoon, she had been knackered beyond belief, Gwen. You wouldn't believe the hours I've been keeping. On the tray, Minnie had placed bags of Oreos, Cheetos, M&Ms, and a liter of Coke. Gwen fairly stared. She was used to the usual disclaimer of the knowledge economy parent. "We have one sweet a week except on a playdate."
"Can I help?" she said belatedly, as Minnie added a handful of Tootsie Rolls. "Please, you sit there and enjoy. Make yourself at home."
To Gwen's surprise, Minnie hoisted the tray up on her shoulder.
"I used to waitress," she laughed. "I mean, not really waitress, but I worked in a restaurant."
Her body flashed with authority as she carried the tray off, her heels clicking as she went. A distinction Gwen had picked up in an anthropology class she'd taken years ago came to mind. that there were two kinds of cultures, shame cultures and guilt cultures. She took a cautious sip of the wine. It was so oaky and medicinal tasting, she almost gagged, forced herself to swallow it. She looked around for something of interest, but the kitchen was without personal effect, as if the Curtises never received mail or made a list on a Post-it or consulted a recipe in a cookbook. What did they do for food? Gwen wondered. She found herself gazing at the hood of the 8-burner restaurant-sized stove. It was like a chrome dragon descending, mouth open, to devour the kitchen. After a couple of minutes, the doorbell rang. Gwen didn't move, praying that the nanny would answer it. But when it sounded again, she got down off the stool reluctantly. Walking through the large, dust-free, heavily furnished rooms, she felt as if she had wandered off from a school field trip to a government building, a treasury or a courthouse, and had ducked under the velvet ropes. Or as if the whole thing was set up as a massive scam, and the hunting prints and oriental rugs could be packed up in 20 minutes flat. She opened the door to Philippa Lai and her two younger children. Philippa had a finger to her chin and looked stricken. "I've been here before," she said to Gwen, coming proprietorially into the apartment, trailed by the little boy and girl. "It didn't used to have 2 floors." "Apparently, no, but I'm sure of it. I'm having the most violent sense of déjà vu." She went on in her peculiar, vacant yet intent way. "I recognize the doorman. It's the same man. I swear I recognized him." Gwen fell to helping the children, getting their coats off and hung up in the closet. When Nan's grandmother lived here, the powder room was right there where the stairs are. It had this faded, striped wallpaper. The little girl was a blonde sausage, her hair cut blunt across, a real towhead. The boy was more like his mother, angles and bones, tall for his age, with a wary frown on his face. He caught sight of the vase of flowers and drew back with an accusatory stare. "I want to go home. My roommate from Dunning, we spent a weekend here," Philippa went on. She was staring through to the dining room now. "I can absolutely see the living room. All the needlework and the chintz and the stacks of manuscripts. Donald Fessenden was in publishing. He started the paperback, as I recall. You know, before it had been only hardcovers. Books weren't accessible to the masses," she clarified, apparently for Gwen's benefit. She stepped slowly back until she was standing right beside Gwen. The physical proximity was as disconcerting as always, given Philippa's holistic self-absorption. "It was so funny. We bought a bottle of vodka, and we were going to sneak it in our rooms. You know, drink it out of the bottle before we went out. And Mrs. Fessenden, Buzzy, Nan's granny, has her maid come and knock on our door. Joy was her name, lovely woman, been with them for years. And invite us to join her for a gin and tonic. She invited us to come and have a drink with her. We were 15. Maybe she thought we were in college. I don't know. I remember Nan saying, 'Well, I guess I could have one more, Granny,' as if she had to be persuaded." Lupe appeared, chuckling as she trundled out from the kitchen with a stack of plastic cups. Philippa gave the woman the same stare her son had given the flowers. "Mommy forgot the cups. I get it. Up and down, the wee is broken. She fix it." Catching sight of Philippa's children, she stopped and mugged an exaggerated happy face. "Ven, ven conmigo." She clapped her free hand on her thigh. "Come, what you waiting for? Arabella is upstairs." The two children stared neutrally, as if not knowing what to make of this apparition, not understanding what it had to do with them. When Lupe repeated her exhortations, Philippa seemed to snap out of her reverie. "Go ahead, you two," she said airily. "Run along." The little girl took the woman's hand after a moment, gazing up at her, but the boy, who had gripped Philippa's thigh as Lupe advanced, began to whine.
"No, Mommy, I don't want to."
Gwen was about to volunteer to take him upstairs to join the others, when Philippa forcibly pulled the little hands apart.
"Don't cling, Sebastian."
He opened his mouth to cry, but before he could, Philippa yanked him forward.
"Ow!"
howled the boy.
"You hurt me!"
For that, he got a mean little push toward the nanny.
"Have fun!"
Yet she stood perfectly still as she watched the party of three ascend the stairs. Sebastian scowling and protesting as Lupe dragged him along.
You're jerking me. You're jerking me.
Ben! Ben!
It's sad, isn't it? Philippa said reflectively. Watching some nanny take your children up the stairs of some hideous apartment. I mean, as if they were any old children. She turned to Gwen and seemed to actually take note of her presence suddenly, as if she had gone into a different mode of being altogether. Searching Gwen's eyes, looking from one to the other, she said,
How many do you have, Gwen?
Me? Oh, I just have the one.
Just one?
Oh, really? Philippa said, though not unkindly. She's an only?
Yes.
Unaccountably, Gwen felt she might start to cry. It was as if the question had short-circuited her system, which was wired for making do, not for bounty. No one ever asked a follow-up question in this town. Questions were proffered only as segues into bragging about oneself or one's children.
Do your children? Because we...
Tears sprang to her eyes. Gwen batted the air and smiled manically to get her breath.
I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
Gwen cleared her throat. One's good, one's fine, you know. Philippa went on observing her until Gwen said, Come on, trying to channel Minnie's peppiness, and led her out of the foyer. In the kitchen, Gwen offered Philippa her own glass of wine.
You take it.
Philippa accepted it, sipped absently.
It's not very good,
Gwen said apologetically, as if it were her fault.
I'm getting shivers.
I remember the little pull-door fridge was over there, with one of those internal ice boxes. And there was a machine for warming bread or plates.
Although I don't understand.
Philippa's voice trailed off as she turned slowly around with a hesitantly pointed finger.
Ah, they've sacrificed the maid's rooms, of course. There'd be no room for dear joy now.
Nan and I wouldn't get our gin and tonics.
Just as well, considering how that night ended up.
She looked at the wine in her hand.
What the hell is this?
I'm not too sure. Philippa drank again from the glass.
For God's sake, wouldn't you think? I mean, with all this money, couldn't she open something nicer?
She gave an irritated look around.
Where's the bottle?
When Gwen looked at her blankly, Philippa said, in the quiet but urgent tone of voice one uses in an emergency,
The bottle of wine. Where's she keeping it?
Oh, Gwen said. She put it back in the fridge. Philippa located the bottle in the refrigerator door and refilled her glass. There was a deft economy to her movements, like those of a practiced thief.
You're not going to tell on me, are you, Gwen?
She asked as she jammed the cork back into the neck. Gwen flushed.
Of course not.
It pained her that from her own abstention, others inferred censure. She didn't really care if people drank or caroused or kept their children up till all hours and left their houses a mess and fed them chicken nuggets every night. She fell silent because she could never think of anything to say. She was embarrassed by her own lack of vices, her plain vanilla competence, the implied aridity of her days. She climbed back onto her stool and pointed at the bottle.
You'd better put it back, though, if you don't want her to know.
Oh, yes, I certainly had better. Philippa said archly, but she did return it to the door. The casement window above the sink was an anomaly in the kitchen, small and rectangular, human-scaled, as if the renovators had missed it. The view, Gwen noticed, was pleasant for a back view. Townhouses, back gardens, a church spire.
I wonder, Philippa said, leaning over the sink and peering out, whether it was Minnie who bought it from the Fessenden estate.
She added defiantly, as if someone had told her she shouldn't.
I'll have to ask.
Gwen would have advised against it. Minnie didn't seem to like it when people had pasts, backgrounds, family, that informed their presence. But Gwen grasped that this was habit or even a pleasure for Philippa, that whenever she knew she had to behave, she would fly in the face of it. Philippa moved with her glass over to the island. Gwen could feel Philippa's eyes on her face, going speculatively over it.
I remember you perfectly, Philippa said.
The dress-up games you and Rose and I used to play.
You do?
Gwen tried not to be flattered, failed utterly, and broke into an idiotic grin. They had never actually spoken about their childhood beyond Gwen's hurried, mumbled explanation when she first saw Philippa at school. She had occasionally wondered if Philippa even remembered how they knew each other. "You and Rose, always playing school. You were nice to her. You let her be the teacher." Oh, I didn't care. Truth be told, Gwen had enjoyed simply being in the Lye sisters' house. It was large, yes, and according to Gwen's dad, it was falling down. "You see that curling on the shingles, all the missing ones? Needs a new roof. Cedar's nice, but it doesn't last." Inside, the rooms were underfurnished. The bedrooms on the third floor where they played empty, save